Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
This episode of Canada Land is brought to you by Douglas, a mattress that is trusted by more than 200,000 Canadians from coast to coast to coast. It's a great mattress at a very reasonable price point. Comes with a 20-year warranty and a great deal for our listeners. Douglas is giving you a free sleep bundle with each mattress purchase. Get the sheets, pillows, mattress, and pillow protectors free with your Douglas purchase today. Visit douglas.ca/CanadaLand to claim this offer. That is douglas.ca/CanadaLand. Hey, I need you to pay close attention to this message. It is not an ad. This is about Canada Land, and this is about you. You need to know that the news crisis is about to get a lot worse. You've heard about the layoffs. We're about to have news closures, and it's very likely that we're going to be seeing the defunding of the CBC. Where are you going to get your information from? What can you do about this? You can support Canada Land. We need you to. And so for this month and this month only, you can become a Canada Land supporter and get everything our supporters get for just $2 a month. That is an almost 80% discount. The clock is ticking on this. It disappears at the end of the month, and then we will not offer it. We need your support. We need to keep news coverage alive in Canada. Go right now to canadaland.com/join. And thank you. Joe Clark is on the show today. Not that Joe Clark, not the Right Honorable Joe Clark, the former Prime Minister of Canada. This is a different Joe Clark. This Joe Clark is, well, what is he? I only recently found out he is a former Toronto Star columnist and Globe and Mail columnist and columnist for Extra, the gay and lesbian newspaper here in Toronto. He is also an author, I have learned. He wrote a book on web accessibility and another book on Canadian English spelling. But that's not how I have known Joe Clark. That's not the writing of his that I've been familiar with. The writing of his that I've known has been in the form of comments to Facebook posts, emails sent to me over the years, and writing on his blogs, and primarily his most recent blog, which is called Canada Land Watch, which you can find at canadalandwatch.wordpress.com. Joe describes the blog as media criticism of media critic Jesse Brown's podcast of Canadian media criticism. And Joe Clark joins me in a moment. Wait for it. This episode of Canada Land is brought to you by David Shepherd, Hans Colburn, Colin, Fenwick McKelvey, Michael Hingston, Adrian Powell, Maxime Rousseau-Bridle, Nicole, Dave Liggett, Craig Silverman, and Nick Morgan. Nick, why did you decide to be awesome?
Because I think that Canada needs independent journalism, but it also needs high-quality journalism. I'm proud to support Canada Land. I think it's money well spent, and I'm looking forward to seeing how this progresses now that it truly is independent and self-sustaining.
This episode is brought to you by the Center for Addiction and Mental Health, CAMH. We hear a lot about the opioid crisis. We talk a lot about the mental health crisis. These are serious problems. These problems affect us all. They've affected my life and my community. They're not intractable problems. I don't know what's going to solve them on a policy level, but day to day, helping people, that's what CAMH does. They do it on the ground when people need help, and they do it through research. The team at CAMH gave our team a tour of their facilities, and we were really just blown away by the incredible, heroic work that they're doing every day. They treat everyone with dignity, and their research is seeking and finding real solutions for everyone. around the world. Help change mental health care forever. Your support will help CAMH build a future where no one is left behind. Donate at CAMH.ca/CanadaLand to help CAMH treat addiction and build hope. This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. It's amazing the things that we tell ourselves to talk ourselves out of getting help. Anybody who's actually gotten help knows that the process of getting things off your chest, of taking your stressors, your problems, and just like not letting them be bottled up, working through just conveying them to somebody, half of the battle is just doing that. You unburden yourself. And you know what? If you have a real mental health professional, no, they don't have magic bullets or magic words that make it all go away. But often they can help you see things a little bit differently and guide you to strategies or tools or to a new perspective that actually does help. As the largest online therapy provider in the world, BetterHelp can provide access to mental health professionals with a wide variety of expertise in mental health. Because you listen to this podcast, you get 10% off of your first month at BetterHelp.com/CanadaLand. That's BetterHelp.com/CanadaLand.
So why do you have my phone number, but I don't have yours?
Would you like my phone number?
It's a bit late now, isn't it? It was a matter of principle at a certain point. It's a bit late now, wouldn't you say? I mean, you've always been able to contact me, whereas the only way one can contact you is through this Gmail. So for months you had my phone number. Why did I never have yours?
Because you make me nervous.
But did you think I was going to crank call you? Like, what? I don't understand that.
I don't know you. You're basically a stranger. I'll tell you what it is. There was...
You're basically a stranger to me, and I gave you my number. Almost no one has my number.
That's fine. That was a decision you made. I took note of one of your comments where you made reference to a car that happens to be the kind of car that I drive.
A Mini?
No.
That's funny. I've been interested in cars since childhood, despite not having a driver's license. I don't remember doing that.
Throughout your criticism of me...
I'm not sure I've been critical of you, but carry on.
I thought you were the media critic.
That's structural and institutional. I don't think you even understand your own métier here. You think that actually attaching someone's name to something is getting too personal. I think that which is nonsense. But you were going to say throughout my criticism of you, so I'm just going to let that slide. I disagree that I'm a critic of yours. I'm also not anti-Jesse Brown. But please finish your sentence.
I don't think that a critic has to be anti, and I don't think that you're necessarily out to get me.
I'm clarifying that. I'm certainly not out to get you. So what's the end of your sentence?
Throughout your writings about me and to me, there have been little aspects that have made me nervous.
Such as?
And I don't know if it's rhetorical flourish or what I should make of it, but there are times when it feels like you are either crossing or blurring the line between what would be a sort of a professional critique and statements about my appearance or speculations about who I am friends with or where I hang out. And then there was this mention of a model of car, which happened to be the kind of car I drive, and it made me nervous.
I have no memory of that. This would have been around Nonfiction 2007?
No, the reference to the car was more recent than that.
I have no memory of doing that.
I'm not making accusations. You asked me a question. I'm giving you an honest answer to your question.
Well, not a very informed one, apparently, because I have no idea what kind of car you drive. It would be fascinating for me to find out. And if we're discussing your
appearance— That is reassuring to hear, and I believe you.
And if we're— Okay. The issue is I describe you as affable, tall, strapping. Well, at the first Nonfiction event, I said you were the first time I'd ever seen you.
Yeah.
I said you were exactly the kind of body type who could get away with this Vietnamese-made linen suiting with the lilac shirt. Of course, that's exactly what
I did. You said nice things about my appearance that were flattering, but they were still things about my appearance.
So what? That's the problem with your coterie of downtown progressive pseudo-intellectual journalists who practice identity politics to the absolute extreme but have no understanding of sociology. But my first question for you is, okay, why have you never at any time publicly acknowledged my existence, Jesse?
Why would I publicly acknowledge your existence?
You're a media critic, and a media critic by definition cannot be above criticism. I run the Canada Land Watch site, which is about your project. Yet the only time you ever acknowledged that was by retweeting something from Brent Morris, who mentioned it.
Well, that sounds like a public acknowledgement.
No, I don't think so. Please let the victim of the crime determine the extent of the crime. No, I don't think so. So you don't.
It was
a
crime that I haven't acknowledged your
blog.
I've used blog in the.
I'm allowed a bit of hyperbole here.
Sure.
here. Yes, in any event. So let's see. You don't follow me on Twitter. Of course, you have to request, but I let you in immediately. You don't respond to anything publicly that I ever post. And even when I fact check your ass, you don't come back and say, well, this is what I did, in fact. Right? If we're discussing private emails, there was a months-long period when I would ask you fact-checking questions and I would get nothing back. So my question is still, why have you not publicly acknowledged my existence?
A, you're here now.
Does that erase the past?
B, and this is my, I'll be very transparent with you about.
I hate that word. Can't you just say honest? Honest or informative, transparent, for God's sake.
Honest is better. It's true. I'm nervous and uncertain about you.
The nervous part I can see. Uncertain, I don't know. And your screen keeps dimming. You can change that, you know?
No, that doesn't show up on the radio.
But I'm looking at it now. I'm experiencing it.
Can I finish answering your question?
This gives you the Blue Velvet Sandman uplighting effect there, which is quite attractive, actually, especially
thank
with that
you, beer. Thank you. I await the description.
My question is nervous. I can see uncertain. I don't understand. So please explain that before we go.
Yeah. So you have – I mean, I don't know what category to place you in. You have a reputation.
Okay. Don't go there yet. Explain to me what you mean by uncertain about me.
I am uncertain about you in terms of like these minute details, which you get very angry about. You seem to have a angry fixation on the difference between instant messaging and email,
stop
typographical.
Stop saying angry.
Well, you're asking me my impressions.
All right,
right?
Fine.
So you've struck me as a very angry person.
Oh, here we go.
That's okay.
It would be okay if it were true. But that's, again, the downtown progressive collective hive mind ejecting someone who does not –
I'm not ejecting.
The loyalty oath. That's correct. I'm here now.
That's right. So, and I think that anger has its place, whether or not you accept the term.
What I'm angry about is you're lying to your patrons and taking the biggest story of your life to the Toronto
Star.
Well,
we can talk about
and
that.
And we are going to talk about that. And the fact that absolutely nothing I do or any of the small number of people like Simon Haupt, who opposes you in a tiny, tiny way, can ever do, will dislodge Jesse Nation, which is the Ford Nation Moncave post-election. All right. So this you're untouchable. I've already published this. You are the only untouchable figure in Canadian media. So in fact, that's okay. I am angry about that. I am angry about that. And frustrated would be a better word, actually. So then my next question on the list here, why do you continue to peddle the lie that you are the only media critic in Canada?
Well, I don't even know if we're finished dealing with the first one. Because you seem to be under the impression that you're here to interview me.
You seem to be under the impression that that's not the case.
Journalists
interview each other. I'm sure – like recently, I've seen that you've been interviewed by these young kids who don't know their ass from a hole in the ground, right? But you probably don't have a lot of experience being interviewed by other experienced journalists. Is that correct? Seasoned journalists have not interviewed you very often. Is that correct?
Not very often, I suppose.
Right. So that's happened to me a lot because I have topic expertise in other areas. So this particular topic comes up. So it could be captioning, could be accessibility, could be typography, could be the TTC, could be any number of other things. So then I interview them. So then we have to have this argument at the outset about how journalists can interview each other. And the answer is, the response to that is, if you ask me a question, I may come back and question the assumptions behind that because, of course, I'm a journalist and I'm all about understanding the assumptions behind things. So when two journalists interview each other, it is not a struggle for dominance. It's equal partners applying the same tools to each other. So I'm not a guest on your show. It is two journalists interviewing each other.
Both things are true. You are a guest on my show, and you're a guest in my studio.
And you could revoke that at any time. It's not even your studio. You rent it, you said. You rent the gear, you just told me off air. So it's fine.
I rent the gear.
It's your house. It's your show.
You are welcome to ask me questions, Joe. And to try to give you a complete answer to your first question, when I add everything up, the fact that you have made multiple references to my personal appearance, the fact that you always talk about my coterie of friends and what part of town I hang out in, the fact that you seem angry about typos and typographical and minutiae that nobody else seems to get upset about.
Because they're equally incompetent.
And the fact that many, many, many people who work in journalism also feel that they get angry emails from you. And the fact that
And where are they now? Where are these anonymous cowards now? I'm not even going to respond to that unless you can attach names to them.
I'm not asking you to respond. I'm responding to your question.
Then you can't bring that up if you don't expect a response.
You're free to respond, but I'm not asking you.
I told you this already back in August when you set up these prerequisites for this goddamn interview back in August. I said, if you're going to have anonymous cowards trying to voice defamatory opinions about me or anything, just any kind of criticism, any kind of, you know, any kind of vituperation, then they have to attach their names to it. And ideally, they'd be in the room. So don't go with this, oh my, don't get this legion of other journalists who think I send them angry emails. Actually, I send them blunt emails because I've been online for 23 years and my emails are just blunt.
This is not a court of law. You're asking me why I didn't give you my phone number. I just told you.
But the precise question was why, when I gave you my phone number, you didn't give me yours.
Yeah. Being in possession of your phone number did not make me feel any more secure about returning it. But I'll tell you something right now. The most alarming thing to me that maybe my mind was playing tricks on, this reference to the car, I absolutely believe that is something that I convinced myself of that is not true.
I
feel no sense of personal threat being in this small studio with you. You're welcome to have my phone number. May we move on?
We've been moving on all through this entire thing. We've had a rollicking, continuously rolling, almost epicyclic conversation so far. You even had Gian Gomeshi in your sights, and I find Hunter's loathsome and appalling, and you know there's no excuse in them whatsoever. But viewing this metaphorically, you had him in your sights with your goddamn crossbow, and then you took it away and ran out of the blind and you know trotted on down to Daddy so that Kevin Donovan could carry your water.
Why don't I go to the Toronto Star? Let's talk about that.
Well, indeed. So much more importantly, since that process started back in the spring, according to your twits and according to what the Toronto Star published twice, that entire process started back in the spring after you got these attestations from three female sources, I believe all of that is correct. So
four sources,
thank you, very good. So this back in the spring that started, yet in October you debuted this funding campaign, which is fine, and that was always going to be a success. It was disingenuous of you to think that was not going to work. It was always going to be a success. But then you also knew that within days, right, at a certain point after that, as things unfolded in a certain manner, and Gian Gomeshi had his little freak out over listening to your podcast, mm-hmm. reading your twit, right? Okay, but at that point, you knew that this was going to be the switch would be flipped, and this would be published in the Toronto Star.
At which point?
Why don't you tell me that? But the most important issue is if we look at the timeline here, you had this information back in the spring.
Yeah.
You chose not to run with it for, I think, incorrect and spurious reasons. And then you also decided to go to the Toronto Star with it, mm-hmm. and knowing at some point that you know the shit would hit the fan and this would be published. And it so turned out, because of events, that happened very shortly after you debuted your crowdfunding campaign, which is premised on the idea that you would be the country's sole independent media watchdog, if I may use that word. Yet the biggest story of your life, you will never have a bigger story than this, I predict. You went straight to the lamestream media with. Why?
Because for me to have debuted on Canada Land would be disastrous for the story. Because
can you explain why that would be true?
Absolutely. I mean, and I won't misrepresent that I had also my own personal reasons for taking to the Star, in that and I know that you find this to be spurious as well, but I don't have libel insurance.
I will discuss that later,
right?
If you don't
mind. So my understanding after consulting with a few lawyers was, A, there is absolutely nothing I could do in my journalism. I could do all sorts of things to make my journalism stand up to a lawsuit. Right? After a lengthy and costly court battle, so that ultimately, based on the responsible communication defense Grant versus Torstar, I would win that lawsuit. But there's nothing I can do to stop
one from being filed.
One from being filed against me, with which I would be solely liable, right? The second part is, if I were to go out on Canada Land as the blogger, the freelance writer breaking this story, the first thing that would have happened, in all likelihood, and this actually is corroborated by when Gomeshi posted his Facebook post, it's clear that he thought he had heard that the Star had dropped the story. He was preparing for a Canada Land story, I believe. So the immediate response would have been to attack my credibility, to attack me personally as somebody who's some bitter ex-CBC. There's the jilted ex-girlfriend, and then there's the freelance writer who's also a jilted ex-girlfriend of the CBC.
You probably meant angry. That's our word of the day.
Angry. And he even, I think, somewhere he said something about how I was a freelance writer who had a problem with him. So he was basically arming—
As does half of the freelance writers in Canada, but carry on.
That's fine. But it was clear to me that this was going to be the defense, was that if you can discredit me and if you can discredit my, you know, this one source who he thought maybe was going to be my only source, then that would have been his plan of attack had it not appeared in the Star. So looking at this from the point of view of my sources, the alleged victims of Gian Gomeshi and their interests—
They're clearly not alleged. You don't have to hedge that.
Well, I think that you're probably right because he hasn't denied that he beat them. But I reserve the right to edit this because I still don't want to get sued. And I think I can do my work without getting sued.
You're still not going to get sued because some of us read defamation law textbooks and case law for fun.
Anyone can sue.
And we're going to get to that.
Anyone can sue anyone,
that is correct.
Joe.
You're getting slightly ahead of that because then we're getting to the response part of this segment. But please carry on with your fulsome explanation of your motivations.
Absolutely. What was necessary, what served the interests of the story, so the public's interest to know, and the interest of my sources who are entrusting me with their story and entrusting me with their identities and were still exposing themselves to some degree, and it would all be for naught if the story was torn down, they themselves discredited, me discredited, and nothing of this were to stick. And so for those reasons, you don't think I wanted to publish this on CanadaLand? You don't think I was dying to publish this on CanadaLand?
Of course, but I'm unfortunately, I can't respond to the emotion you just displayed there. I'd prefer to respond to the facts you've
all right. Well, I suspect you have a counter argument, but I hope you don't dispute that is the argument that was what I was the basis that I was operating on.
All right, and we did hear most of that before. Although the bit you just said a moment ago about how that essentially that the credibility of the sources and your credibility would be destroyed by
I don't know it forces. Certainly would have been challenged.
Lots of things are challenged. You're being challenged right now, and you're holding up fine.
Thank you.
So these, but that's predicated on the notion that your reporting was inaccurate.
No, the lawsuit would have been predicated.
No. Any challenge, any attempt to deconstruct your reporting or the sources, that would be predicated on the fact that they were lies, essentially.
No, not but even necessarily. Not. I think you can even attack. You can even file a libel claim based on malice. If he felt that I was operating out of malice, if he felt that I didn't report it responsibly.
Malice and responsibility are two different things. Malice has multiple senses in defamation law, but by far the primary one is. An intent not encapsulated by the words in dispute. So it doesn't just mean hatred. It doesn't mean you hate Gian Gomeshi's guts, as so many of us do. Okay, I was an early adopter of hating Gian Gomeshi's guts. Okay, please, I
hated, ahead of the trend on that one.
I hated Gian Gomeshi.
All of a sudden, everybody always hated him. It's news to me.
Before they sold out. So yeah. Hold on. Now, so we go back to the. I will accept at some level that you wanted to shoot the crossbow and take him down. Skin is hide. Certainly,
I'm not agreeing to that characterization.
I
wanted to tell the truth on CanadaLandShow.com.
And the effect of that would be the same. And I suppose actually, if you admitted that could be imputed as malice in the definition I just described. So that's fine. But I'm allowed to characterize it that
Joe,
way.
Joe, you clearly have you a more thorough no. understanding of the law than
well,
I
then
do.
Why don't you let me finish and tell you more about it? Because this is an informational segment. Okay, right. Okay, so yes, it is true that no one can. There is no power that can prevent other people from filing frivolous lawsuits against you.
Yeah.
Selma Bouvier,
as he has done to the CBC.
Selma Bouvier, I have a lucrative hobby filing frivolous lawsuits. Of course, yes. That was a positioning statement, and that's not going to go anywhere. And it's
fine. As would his lawsuit against me have been warning to other media.
That doesn't seem to have deterred the CBC at all. All right, so let's assume this.
Because it came out in the Toronto Star.
Yes, okay, slow down. I'm trying to go through this piece by piece. Let's imagine the first couple of days. In the first couple of days, he could have found a lawyer easily who could have filed a defamation complaint against you, which, as you know, starts with a letter that has to be served properly, demanding an apology and retraction, stating the words that are complained of and why they are defamatory.
Sure.
But by day 3 or 4 or 7 or 10, when I'm going to mangle her name, Lucy de Couture and other victims came forward by name, and there came to be an avalanche of evidence on this.
Would they have come forward if it was on my blog and I was facing a lawsuit?
I think it's entirely possible. But I'm going on the fact that the topic we're discussing right now is what would you be sued for defamation? So at that point, as more victims came forward, also as any lawyer did due diligence on Gian Gomeshi and, for example, looked at the same pictures and video that we later learned he had shown to the CBC, right? It'd be very difficult to find a responsible lawyer who would write a letter claiming that those statements were false and defamatory, because the lawyer would know that they're not false and defamatory, and the lawyer is ethically bound not to make false attestations.
What if Gomeshi was lying to the lawyer?
Well, that's the thing. You could get Lionel Hutz. It's true. He could get Lionel Hutz, who doesn't do correct due diligence. But in defamation law, defamation law is a very complex area of law, and he could find some. And
it's
some
possible that he's
lawyer.
Been lying to a lot of people, which is why a lot of people have dropped him.
Fine. Let's just accept that as stipulated.
The CBC has alleged that he was lying to them.
Okay, great. And then, of course, if you're given what is incorrectly known as a libel notice, if you're given a demand for an apology and retraction, you immediately publish it. The first thing you do is take a picture and put it on Twitter. Then you scan it and put it on your blog. And then you say, I will not be muzzled. Then the game is on. But the ball is in your court. You have the court of public opinion in the palm of your hand, right? I mixed a couple of metaphors there. It's true. You are in control of the narrative at that point. They've alleged that your writing is defamatory by having to restate the allegedly defamatory words and why they're defamatory. And that makes the papers. Even if you never become the Vichy-like collaborationist you did with the Toronto Star, then it hits the Toronto Star. Okay,
Vichy-like
collaborationist with the Toronto Star. Then it hits the papers.
Right.
And then it becomes a hot topic. And that, even if people like Ms. de Couture had not come forward, they would at that point because, now there's some heat around this. Okay, then next, let's imagine that things go terribly for you. Things go terribly for you. And in fact, he finds a lawyer, a competent lawyer, knows defamation law and is willing to file a complaint in, I believe, divisional court. Anyway, they actually take you to court about it. Well, I asked around. So, for example, I asked Peter Downert, who wrote the book Libel, one of the several books I read for pleasure in my spare time, wouldn't this be an obvious case of a matter of enormous public interest that could set a serious precedent? And wouldn't you do pro bono work for Jesse Brown in this case? And he wrote back saying, maybe I'd have to think about it. That's not a no. So,
do you think that I asked lawyers if they would take this on pro bono when I was researching this?
I would expect you did, yes. But did you ask someone like Peter Downert?
I asked some of the most prominent libel lawyers in the country. I spoke to three different lawyers.
Not Downert. Because he answered my questions.
Joe.
That's proof that you
would
never talk to
them. Any way you slice it, it would have been a massive, irresponsible gamble. To what end?
Stop saying irresponsible.
It would not be responsible to my sources. It would not be responsible to my family. And you know what? It worked out okay.
Except for lying to your contributors. Well, on the pretext that you were an independent media critic, when the biggest story of your life you ran to daddy with.
Now, my 1,400 plus contributors, of which you are not one.
No, and never will be.
Not one of them has taken issue with this.
So it's not a popularity contest. We're not kidding. It is a popularity contest. That's all this is. This is actually a plebiscite about Jesse Brown and his chirpy bonhomie and how he's one of our people. And he can do no wrong. Okay, so don't try to pull that on me. Okay,
just ridiculous. They don't care if the truth comes out on Canada Land or Toronto Star. They care if the truth comes out.
You're changing the subject now. All right, let me look at this here. Okay, tell me about the contract with the Star.
What would you like to know?
Everything about it. How much did they pay you?
I would be happy to tell you that. They don't want me to. I can tell you that they paid me industry standard rates.
You signed a gag order?
No, I'm a freelancer who is constantly making contracts with different media organizations. And the practice in the industry, if you ever want to work again, is you don't tell people what you're getting paid.
And this is one of the fundamental, this is one of the category errors of your show. You'll talk about other people's money, but not your guests and not your own. That's insane.
No, that's not true. And in fact—
Well, it is constantly true. Yes, they put that comedian on the show, and I don't know why. And the Mark McKinney episode today was another joke, by the way. Like, why don't you get an actual television executive in here and ask why comedy isn't working on television instead of having these comedians, like an episode recorded obviously before October based on the reference in the show? Like, when you got that comedian on here, you talked about how much the going rate was for a stand-up show. But we never asked her how much she made. So it's
now who's changing the topic?
No, we're the topic is your refusal to actually you claim to be interested in money. You're extremely concerned when, say, a union or the Chinese government funds journalism in some way, right? Right, you feel that that's tainting journalism, or Peter Mansbridge takes speaking fees. In fact, you're very concerned with money. You should be, because that is, money from the wrong source for the wrong reason can taint journalism.
Sure.
We acknowledge that, of course. But when it comes to someone sitting in the room, you lose your nerve. How much do you earn from stand-up, you should have asked. You don't. You can't. You can't bring yourself to do that.
Let's slow down a minute here. To the question of, is it of interest to my audience and part of my journalism to get the figures? Depends. If I'm having somebody here for a conversation about what's right and what's wrong in the comedy scene, the stand-up comedy scene in Toronto, do I need to be – sometimes you need to be rude. Sometimes you need to demand things that people don't want to disclose. Sometimes that adds to the editorial package. That also can make people not want to come on your show. So on a case-by-case basis, I determine whether or not that information is relevant and necessary. In the case of a comedienne talking about how hard it is to make a living in the Toronto stand-up scene, asking her specifically what her income is not that fucking important.
I didn't say income. I said how much does she get per show, because you talked about what the general pay scale is for stand-up, and I said, well, how much do you get? So what? But
I wasn't examining this episode. Yeah, the point of the episode was we lionized
Camilla Gibb for talking about how difficult it is for a mid-list author to make a living these days, and you claim it's on a case-by-case basis. It's across the board. You will not shut up about the corrosive effect of union funding on the Tai and the Chinese sending people on junkets.
I don't think I said anything about that being corrosive.
Re-listen to your own episode. You keep talking about the union, which you didn't even identify, funding the Thai. You talked about it's not Enbridge. What's the name of the energy company that takes out ads and so on in the National Post, the Post Media newspapers? They must be expecting something for their
cap,
contribution,
Enbridge.
Precisely right. People don't want to come on your show. Well, tons of people don't want to come on your show, and tons of people do. I've been trying to get on your show since August. And if you're really concerned that asking one person in a friendly environment that you don't, if you're trying to tell them that you don't have enough skill and charm as an interviewer to gently pull that simple bit of information out of a source, I find that incredible. And besides,
you're lecturing me about charm, Joe.
You have tons of it. You have charm. So that's.
But it didn't even occur to me to ask her that.
But, well, that's the problem.
It wasn't.
That's the problem.
It was totally irrelevant to the interview.
It's not. It wasn't. You said you kept asking what the going rate was. Now, on the topic of Jan Wong and gag orders, I also don't. Another thing I don't see you covering these days is how Jan Wong is being serially mistreated. Are you going to get Chris Selly on to explain the rationale behind his hit piece against her?
Oh, I would love to talk with him about that.
Well, I tried, by the way, and his response was...
It's been a busy year, Joe. And you have a very high expectation of me.
Well,
I appreciate
that. Well, fine. And I asked Chris Selly about that. I said, and his response is, what is Canada Land Watch? And I wrote back saying, what is Google?
Maybe you're learning a little bit about why you don't get as many interviews as you would like.
What do you mean? I don't go... What are you talking about? I don't go soliciting interviews. Where'd you get that impression?
You wanted Chris Selly to talk with you.
No. I asked him a couple of questions about this and whether it actually indicated that Toronto journalists have an in crowd and an out crowd. And Jan has suddenly been put on the out crowd. So on her principled stand on gag orders.
Remember, can you stop trying to scoop my episode on Jan Wong?
No.
Is it coming up?
I have no knowledge that you don't have. So journalists cannot agree to gag orders. Gag orders are unethical for journalists.
I never agreed to a gag order.
You agreed not to disclose how much the Star is paying you. Getting back to a previous topic, popping up a stack, if you don't mind. Why did you mislead the audience that you were going to fearlessly pursue independent media criticism when the biggest story of your career, even according to your claims, could only have been published by the Toronto Star?
Why did I mislead them? My God.
You had that all in process for months.
First of all, I've explained in detail why I went to the Toronto Star with that story. Why did I launch the Patreon knowing that story would only come out through a partnership with another organization? Because the show needed money or it was going to go away. At no point did I ever promise that everything that I ever publish will come out on Canada Land, and at no point did anybody really expect that.
That's false. You constantly use the word independent.
That's right, and right? I am.
You're not independent if you're co-bylined with Kevin Donovan of the Toronto Star. And by the way, that means you can never report on the Toronto Star again because you're in there.
Then I can't report on any of the many other organizations that I have worked for or might still work for.
No, present day only. Like you can still you've worked for the corpse and you're having no problem reporting about them. No, the past has nothing to do with it. It's the present day that's the issue.
This is like fascistic.
And no one,
Joe,
it is
let's
not.
Say that
and
I only got $1,000
just
the
a
Patreon.
Second. It is not true that no one expected you never to write for the lamestream media. It's implicit. You made an implied covenant.
So you think it was an implied covenant that as soon as I asked for a dollar for my audience.
Don't call me a fascist.
No. What is fascistic and ideological to me and is unyielding and unreasonable is for you to assert to me that had I, let's say, only gotten $1,000 a month from my audience, okay? $12,000 a year minus the Patreon fees and the credit card fees. So how was I going to make up the rest of my income? Would I have been a hypocrite if I had gone and taken a column with a magazine or a newspaper, even though I'm reporting on them? What did you expect? Everybody else understands that. Only you seem to find that to be...
Everyone else excuses it. And what you're describing as unyielding application of principle is exactly that, right? Because some ethics are non-negotiable. And on your question, well, if my funding drive had only succeeded part way, which was never going to be true, if it had only succeeded, it's come on, you're much too popular for that. You're always going to get enough. Okay, the salient question, Jesse, is: would people have objected if I had planned all along to deliver a huge story to the lamestream media? And we know now the answer is no, they wouldn't. And you're using their acquiescence to that unethical practice as a weapon against me. I don't mind being the only person telling you acted unethically. I have no problem doing that. It doesn't mean that I'm incorrect for saying it. Doesn't mean it. Right. Your Patreon campaign, Canada Land, and Jesse Brown are popularity contests. But this ethical discussion is not a popularity contest, and it's not a vote. It's not subject to a vote. And all these people who aren't telling you they object, well, that's an absence of evidence. It's not evidence of absence. You don't know that they object. Simon Haupt has all sorts of objections to you. He kicked it in anyway. He kicked money in anyway. So the ethical issue is you're have always contended you were the only media critic in Canada, even when that was never true, right? But that's really – I find that offensive.
We can talk about that too, Joe.
We find that offensive to the core. But then, lady, you started this funding campaign promising true independent media criticism, which this country dearly needs. And then your first story is with the Toronto Star.
Now, my first story is with
– sorry, that's incorrect. The giant story, really the king-making story was with the Toronto Star.
A king.
Just to tidy up a little bit about the libel insurance business.
Oh God, not more of that.
Well, no,
all right.
Because you always use that phrase a lot, including in this spontaneously in this conversation.
Okay.
So, even if you have libel insurance, that just means you don't have to pay the lawyer; you still have to go to court, and that could still happen.
Yes.
It's
in a year, Canada Land will be in a place where I can break a story like that, both in terms of its credibility and in terms of its insurance. It will be in a position to break stories like that.
Well,
what I want to say to you is this, and what I hope that you
understand. Apparently there's something you want to say to me.
I am in uncharted territory, and I am
dealing. How? How? What territory is uncharted? You're running a journalistic podcast. There are tons of those.
I'm running an independent media project, the likes of which I, at least, am not familiar with a precedent that I can base my actions on. So on an ad hoc basis, I am navigating unfamiliar waters, trying to serve the truth and trying to serve my audience and trying to create a business and trying to do the work that I like and trying to talk to people I find interesting as well as expose things that need to be exposed. I do this on now a twice a week basis, and the public trust that I have with my audience, people are not idiots, is measured by the support that they can revoke at any time. It does not mean that I'm always right that they continue to sponsor the show.
I don't think funding is the only measure of accountability. I
just said that.
You just said that it is the only measure of accountability.
No, I'm saying that I have a public trust.
They can revoke that support at any time.
That's right.
Well, incredibly enough, you may find that this beggars the imagination, but I support your project, but you just simply will not acknowledge my criticism of it and my fact-checking, your lack of fact-checking, to use
Let me fact-check your fact-checking, Joe.
Please do.
This is from your most recent one of your most recent posts.
Which most recent one?
The post about Courtney Shea's profile of Gomeshi in Toronto Life. How much did Shea know but refused to publish, you asked? If only we had an independent media critic to explore such questions. Can we just say that you're speaking about me, though you refuse to use my name?
Of course, refuse. Come on. I was being allegorical.
But that might result in bruised egos and lost friendships and cold glances at downtown progressive journal booze ups.
You just finished telling me that you can't ask people how much they earn because one of the criteria that goes into getting people on the show is essentially not offending them.
Every minute spent investigating actual facts is a minute stolen from interviewing ex-girlfriends and crooning cousins on one's podcast.
Absolutely.
The claim here, I hope you will agree, is that I did not ask Courtney Shea how much she knew but refused to publish.
No, it's not a claim. It's a speculation. And it's a rhetorical speculation.
If only
and
we had always, an independent media critic to explore
and
such questions.
Always in the back of my mind, Jesse, and this is not just disingenuous, and I assure you this is completely accurate and truthful, always in the back of my mind, Well, I was thinking he has talked to her, and he and she did the same thing to him. She did the same thing to him that she did to me, which is you have to go through the editor. And then the next thing is he's probably also talked to the editor.
I've spoken to both of them. Why didn't you just ask me?
Exactly. So in the back,
why didn't you just ask me?
Because I didn't.
Why didn't you fact check your speculation, your suggestion that I didn't do my job?
I chose to write in a rhetorical manner.
Well, that allowed you to write something that essentially was not truthful.
No. Didn't make a claim. Did not make a claim. Well, it is true that you put an ex-girlfriend and a crooning queer cousin on the show. Those are truthful statements.
It's slippery at best.
You just didn't like my approach there. But I just finished.
No, I don't like you suggesting that I didn't do something that I actually
and
did.
Another thing I thought while I was writing this, which I put a shitload of effort into, like going to the library, getting that actual copy of the thing, looking her up. Right. I also gave her I gave her tons of shit in that post, which you're not giving me credit for. Okay. Another thing that occurred to me, of course, is by writing this, this gives you an opening at a later time when you actually do have some kind of expose about Courtney Shea and Mark Pupo and what they knew. Hold on. And what the entire organization knew. If you finally have an expose about that, you get a delicious bit of comeuppance. You get a delicious bit of comeuppance.
I don't have an expose. They didn't know. There's no conspiracy
then
here,
just,
man.
Then you just blew your story by telling me that.
What story did I blow?
Well,
that the Toronto Life suppressed the information that I published with the Toronto Star?
No, they didn't know. I didn't suggest that. Because I support what you're doing. You have a lot of details around the edges and actually some at the core that need to be altered. But I do support what you're doing. But
Joe,
here we go.
You have a thorough background in news journalism that I want you to share with our listeners in a moment.
Not hard news. I never wrote hard news.
Okay.
That doesn't mean anything.
There are standards for reporting that shift wildly from newsroom to newsroom and organization to organization. And they are all each respective news organ's attempt to create a standard of credibility and to have responsible reporting. The problem in this country is that they are too often uses excuses to not report. You can be so responsible in your standards that you don't actually break any goddamn news. So I do things a little bit differently. I refuse to have the standard of one organization or another thrown at me. There's no bar you need to be called to be a journalist.
I'm aware of
that.
There's
no licensing body.
Well, you're suggesting there are these equivalently viable protocols that are all slightly different. And,
well, they're kind of wildly different from place
okay,
to place.
Well, fine. But really,
so the ultimate metric is, are the stories true? And my stories hold up. And it allows me to publish things that other people aren't publishing.
Okay.
And that's the service I provide.
Well, it's true that – okay. So I don't think we're actually disputing the core value that if you claim that a person said or did something, you have to double check that. They may say no and they may be lying to you or they may not answer you and they may be dodging the question. You may still publish anyway. That's precisely what happened with Gomeshi, right? But you still have to make the effort.
Sure.
Right? And you and I have you've explained to me in private email correspondence that you prefer to just shoot off Gmail sometimes instead of calling them up, right? Because often they won't talk to you on the phone. But the problem—
No, I prefer to call them up, but they won't talk to me on the phone.
Well, except then I listed to you an alternate scenario which you could try, and that and for very high profile things like in the Yateem case, where essentially you're accusing the hack there of recapitulating the defense's evidence, the defense's private evidence, right? You can't get something important like can't get a response to something important.
I didn't accuse her of that. My sources, who were reporters who were at that hearing,
yes, and
accused her of that.
You reported them. Well, that's a distinction without much of a difference because, of course, it's under your.
It means it's substantiated, Joe.
Well, of course, yes, I know. That is what they're saying. I know that is what they're saying. But to get a comment from Mary Rogan, was it?
Yes, that's right,
Mary Rogan. To get a comment from Mary Rogan on something serious like that, you positively can't do it in writing because you tip off the source and then you won't.
And then
get
she
it.
Doesn't. Let's say she doesn't talk to me on the phone. Do I not publish the piece?
You tell her that I need to talk to you on the phone or in person about a serious issue.
Let's say she won't talk with me on the phone. Do I still publish the piece?
Yes.
And would not the piece be stronger if I had comment from her, even if it was an email form?
But she was never going to give you a comment on that, and that was borne out. So
she gave me a no comment, which is better than no comment.
Well, in some ways, yes. Now, would you mind terribly, Jesse, since we're already over time, you're basically accusing me of eating up too much time. Would you mind terribly, if we got back to something that I considered important? Would you mind if we sort of change the subject to something that I considered important?
I'm having a blast. Let's do it.
You didn't not seem to be having a blast. Okay, so let's do two things. Okay, do you remember your show notes from episode 13?
I do.
Okay. See the block quoted area, which I'm
sure
there. Apologies to listeners for the paper noise. I was told not to bring paper after I already brought paper. So can you read your statement to me in your Jesse Brown voice? Can you
I'd love to Jesse Brown? I'd love to read it. Again, it makes for great radio.
In your own Jesse Brown.
What I want, what I'm hoping to kind of work towards. This stuff always.
What I want, what I'm
you want
to
me to
kind
like,
of work
you want
towards.
Me to sell it?
Sell it, baby.
All right. What I want, what I'm hoping to kind of work towards is a greater realization that it's okay to be critical of one another in this industry, the same way that we're critical of every other industry and institution. You know that thing that journalists do where we afflict the comfortable and comfort the afflicted, where we ask tough questions? We need to do that to ourselves. It's a cultural thing, and it's the culture that I'm trying to play some role in changing, that things not be so chummy and incestuous, and that we understand that that's what we do professionally. It's not personal. That's the way things are in a lot of other countries that have a robust press, free discourse. I think that that is what is really desperately needed here. And I think that I have to not get so frustrated that it hasn't happened yet, you know, just 3 months into this project.
Well done.
Thank you.
Every year there's a Night of a Thousand Stevies in New York where drag queens and some females show up as Stevie Nicks. I suggest we inaugurate Night of a Thousand Jessies. So with a thousand of us show up with microphones and do Jesse Brown. You do Jesse Brown as well as Cher does Cher.
Why did I just read that?
Well, we have a couple of points of principle here.
Uh-huh.
So the big one there, and this is pinned to the top of my web log, right? And I say we should always hold you to these things, that asking tough questions and critiquing each other is not personal. Right?
Yeah.
Okay. First of all, I don't think you really ask tough questions and critique the personalities. So, and the classic case of this, which you and I have been talking about since August, is looking at the media power couples who occupy too many slots in the media already, right? Ian Brown and Johanna Schneller and Sarah Fulver, daughter of Wedgie, and Stephen March, and Elizabeth Renzetti and Doug Saunders, like these married couples that occupy all these slots, right? You don't want to touch that because I guess I'm inferring that you find that too personal.
Well, what would our fondue party be like if I went into that?
That's the thing. That's the thing. I mean, surely wasn't it Joan Didion who explained that journalists are always selling out their sources, and if they're your friends, that's still true. Now, you've accused me before in private email of getting personal.
Joe.
And you consider that getting too personal.
I don't want to waste your time here because I got to cut out what you just said because you just mentioned the name of two individual people who don't even cover these issues. You mentioned a journalist who covers municipal politics and you brought his sexuality and his Judaism into question.
Hold on. In my piece, I describe how he does, in fact, talk about things that aren't just municipal politics. I did not reveal that some civilian person who has no power, no public profile is gay or Jewish. That is not what happened. And of course, you, as a heterosexual male journalist, the heterosexual male journalist does nothing but act as a gatekeeper over what the gay and lesbian journalist can factually report.
You can report anything you want. You can single out anyone you want. Perhaps you'll step over some law.
And that's not going to happen given my knowledge of defamation law.
The only thing that you might be sacrificing if you are mean, if you are angry, if you are unfair, if you are inaccurate, or if you pick enemies.
I'm almost never inaccurate.
What you sacrifice potentially is your credibility and whether or not anyone wants to listen to you.
Define listen.
If anyone wants to hear what you have to say, read your site, listen to you on my show.
Well, so you'll know, the reason why I even publish things like this is so that they can be found by other like-minded people.
Look, you promised that if I post this interview, you're going to stop criticizing Canada Land.
Would you like to know why that is?
No, I don't want to know why it is. I just want you to know that I don't want you to do that, that I don't think anybody should take on my word that I'm going to hold up these standards and they shouldn't scrutinize what I'm doing. I think that you certainly have the means to do this in a perpetual way. It seems like you got the time. I think everybody says they want transparency. I know you love that word. Nobody really wants to be held accountable, especially when they fuck up. I don't want you to catch me on something. I imagine you eventually will. That might actually stick. I think it needs it. And I think it would be incredibly hypocritical of me to say that I want you to go away and stop doing this when I'm doing this to so many other people.
Nothing's going to stick. Jesse Nation will back you to the hilt. To your next appointment
Joe,
in 10 minutes.
I've been in dialogue with you before. I'm in dialogue with you now. I'm not going anywhere. If you want to keep doing this, I consider it a service. And I thank you for coming here and speaking with me today.
Jesse, you have a lot to learn.
That was your Canada Land show. I hope you endured it. You can email me always at jesse@jessebrown.ca. I read them all. I respond when I can. I'm on Twitter at Jesse Brown, and the website is canadalandshow.com. The crowdfunding site is at patreon.com/CanadaLand. I produced this show with Christopher DeMello, and this week's episode of Canada Land Shortcuts will be up on Thursday morning. If you like this show, support it. Hey, I need you to pay close attention to this message. It is not an ad. This is about Canada Land, and this is about you. You need to know that the news crisis is about to get a lot worse. You've heard about the layoffs. We're about to have news closures, and it's very likely that we're going to be seeing the defunding of the CBC. Where are you going to get your information from? What can you do about this? You can support Canada Land. We need you to. And so for this month and this month only, you can become a Canada Land supporter and get everything our supporters get for just $2 a month. That is an almost 80% discount. The clock is ticking on this. It disappears at the end of the month, and then we will not offer it. We need your support. We need to keep news coverage alive in Canada. Go right now to canadaland.com/join. And thank you.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.